This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to the Best of Sounds Like Canada. You're listening to our podcast of the day's highlights of Sounds Like Canada, and you can catch our full show on CBC Radio 1 at 10 o'clock or a couple of times a day on Sirius Satellite Radio 137.
They told us that he would just not have a white-collar job. That's the only thing, and that was not a big deal to my husband and I. My husband didn't have a white-collar job either. So we felt that that wasn't something that would be an issue with us.
That is Audrey Hilscher talking about the son she adopted 30 years ago. This morning, our producer Suzanne Dufresne brings us the story of Russ Hilscher, part of the first generation of children diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. The term was first used in North America in 1973 by doctors in Washington State. It was a diagnosis that no one could have predicted would have such far-reaching and devastating consequences. Suzanne is in our Winnipeg studio with more on the story. Suzanne, good morning.
Good morning.
No white-collar job for Russ. That's all that they told her at the time about raising a child with FAS?
That's right, Sheila. Russ was placed with the Hilscher family in 1977 when he was 3 months old. Jim was a truck driver, Audrey a foster mom. Russ was formally diagnosed with FAS just a few months after he went to live with them.
And eventually Audrey and Jim adopted him, right?
Yeah, they did.
Why did they suspect Russ had FAS in the first place?
Well, Audrey says they came up with the diagnosis because the child welfare agency involved knew for a fact that the mother drank during her pregnancy. And also because Russ had the facial characteristics of FAS. The small eyes, thin upper lip, smooth philtrum, that's the space between the upper lip and the nose. And to be fair, the diagnosis was really so new. It had only been around for a few years at that point. The medical community knew FAS was permanent, that it was damaged to the central nervous system, especially the brain, but they didn't really know what it would mean as these children grew up.
So what was Russ like as a baby?
Oh, cute. You know, Audrey says he was very sweet, usually quiet and cooperative. If you put him down at 6:30 at night, he'd sleep right through until 6:30 the next morning. But as he got a little bit older, they noticed signs that something was off.
Everything that he did was behind. He sat up when he was around 9 months old, and he walked when he was around 18 months. But every time something went wrong, when he was playing with it, he would just lose his control and go flying, you know, or throw things. Like, it was regular kid stuff, just like other kids that I've taken care of, but it's more traumatic.
And that frustration, Sheila, and sometimes explosive behavior continued as he got older. Russ also has been diagnosed with an IQ of less than 70. He dropped out of school in grade 10. Russ says he was picked on a lot, and it was really hard for him to cope with all the distractions of just regular school life. During our interview, I asked him to help me understand what it's like to live with FAS, and this is how he described it.
It's like there's always a storm going on in my brain. With, you know, it just not connecting from, you know, point A to point B, it's not connecting very well and so on. So it's just like a big storm with lightning and thundering and, you know, rainy in my, that's how I would describe my FASD.
And because of this storm in his brain, as Russ puts it, he also suffers from memory loss, poor reasoning skills. He's very suggestible and compulsive.
Suzanne, are those common characteristics of people with FAS?
Well, no two people, of course, are the same, but you're right. There are some very common traits. And I need to take just a second to give you a little more background here. Since we first heard about FAS in 1973, doctors have come up with a few other terms. One is FASD, that's fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It's not a medical diagnosis, but it's used as an umbrella term to cover people like Russ who have FAS. There's also a diagnosis of partial FAS, and there are people who suffer from alcohol-related neuro quote, developmental disorders. That comes with no facial characteristics at all, but everyone has some level of brain injury. And, you know, in those cases where they don't have the facial cues, the experts I spoke with say life can be just as hard for them.
Because they appear physically to look like anyone else, but they're not.
That's exactly right, Sheila. They look like you and me, carry on a seemingly regular conversation, but their cognitive ability, what they actually understand, may be that of an 8 or 9-year-old. Brenda Bennett calls it the invisible disability. She's the executive director of FASD Life's Journey in Winnipeg. They provide some residential and outreach support in the community. Here's how she sees people with FASD.
They're so ill-equipped to manage in the world. They look normal. However, hidden beneath their typically normal bodies is all of those areas that are so profoundly in deficit, like their ability to tell what the difference is between safe and dangerous, between real and imagination, being able to predict what will happen if they make certain choices, and not even able to, in many cases, retain learning. So they may make the same mistakes over and over and over and over again.
So, Suzanne, in Russ's case, bad choices over and over and over again, being highly suggestible, sounds like he was headed for a lot of trouble.
Yeah, he was. He was in and out of jail for more than a decade for property crimes, for auto theft. Audrey says they tried really hard to keep him on the right track, but you just couldn't be with him 24 hours a day.
At one point, it was just living and hoping he survived the winter. Because the winter was the worst time of the year when he would be found somewhere, unsupervised, and not in a state of mind to go home on his own. Often, if he got into jail, the remand center mostly, in wintertime, I was relieved because I knew he was safe there. And I didn't have to be concerned about what was happening. Somebody had beat him up, you know, that kind of thing happened, or he was hurt.
Suzanne, it just sounds absolutely heart-wrenching.
You know, it is. It's been a really long road for them. Audrey says a big part of the problem was a lack of services and a lack of just general understanding about FAS. A lot of people thought they were just bad parents. Why can't you teach your kid a lesson? Why won't he learn? You know, that kind of thing. So for them in Russ's younger years, it really was a case of trial and error. At one point, Audrey told me family services stuck him in a group for people who'd been sexually abused because they just did not know what else to do with them. And while the situation has improved, there's still limited support for people with FASD, especially if they're older. But there are organizations like Brenda's, who we heard from earlier, that work with older teens and adults. And that's really important because there can be a big disconnect, for example, when kids in the child welfare system turn 18.
What happens?
Well, there was a recent report in Manitoba that estimated that almost 20% of the kids in care have FASD, and it called for more services to help them transition into adulthood. To illustrate that, Brenda told me the story of one girl who was given an apartment, a place to live, when she turned 18 by Child and Family Services, but she wasn't hooked up with any other agencies, so even though she'd been diagnosed with FAS and had an IQ of less than 70, she wasn't put in touch with welfare. She didn't have any supervision. So she ended up losing the apartment because she couldn't pay the rent and lived on the street for the next few years. I'll let Brenda with FASD Life's Journey pick up the rest of the story.
When I first met her, I'd had a telephone call from a local hospital in the city of Winnipeg, and they had said, you know, we have this young lady. She tells us that she's been diagnosed with FAS as a child. She's about 20 years old. She's was brought in by the police. They had found her half naked hanging off the second story windowsill of an apartment. She was really badly beaten and claimed that this man was trying to kill her. She's refusing service right now, so we can't keep her. Is there anything that you can do to help this young lady? So that was the first phone call. So of course, off we went up to the hospital, and they had her partitioned off in a private room in the emergency ward. We offered her a foster placement in a Proctor setting, and she thought that that might be really good. As long as people understand how she learns, that was really important for her because she was someone who had experienced tons of failure in her life because people just punished her because she didn't do things right. She spoke of being put in a plastic bag and as punishment when she was growing up and put out in an outhouse in northern Manitoba in the winter.
Oh, Suzanne, I mean, that sounds absolutely tragic and hopeless. Where is she now?
Well, she actually went to live with Brenda for a time. Now she's got her own place that she shares with another woman who has FASD. It's in a supervised setting, so she does have a worker who checks on them regularly and helps them make decisions and, you know, just survive day-to-day living.
And that support and understanding sounds so, so important. Are there other places like that for people like her and like Russ?
There are a few. The Mennonite Central Committee also runs a very limited program for adults with FASD. They've been working with Russ, actually, for the past 2 years or so.
And how is Russ doing?
Well, like anything, Sheila, you know, he's had his ups and downs, but overall, it's made a huge difference for him. Here's what he says about his life now.
I'm happy with my life. I'm happy that the way things are. 5 years ago, when I was always in and out of jail, I wouldn't have thought that I would be working. I didn't think that I would have my own apartment. Didn't think that I would ever have, daily supports or even want daily supports. And, and have a girlfriend and stuff like that. So, yeah, those are all stuff that I didn't think I would have 5 years ago, so.
I love how he puts that. I have a girlfriend and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he has a girlfriend and a job. That's terrific.
That's right. He works 4 days a week at the First Nations Education Resource Center in Winnipeg as an office assistant. He does the filing and the photocopying, cleans up the lunchroom, that kind of stuff.
And what kind of support does he get from the Mennonite Central Committee?
A lot. He has a worker with him 12 hours a day from 10:30 in the morning until 10:30 at night.
I get driven to work and from work. One that's just to help with the impulsivity, because guaranteed if I had to go to work on my own, I say about half I wouldn't make it there, and the other half I would. You know, taking the bus to work and I see someone or something on the street or see somewhere I want to go and I'll pull the bell and get off and forget about work.
And his MCC partner, Sheila, stays with him at work. So he doesn't, and here's the example that his boss gave me. So Russ doesn't decide in the middle of the day that he needs to go get his haircut.
That old impulse thing again, eh?
That's right. You know, if he gets the impulse and no one's there to say, Russ, you have to wait until after work to go and get your haircut, off he'd go. The MCC also helps Russ manage his money because that's a really big piece for him. If he has it, he wants to spend it all at once. Here's Jewel Reimer, who runs the program.
Then we'll go to the bank with him and we'll be very, we have to do some really practical interventions. We'll come with about 5 different envelopes. We'll label them. This is paying this 20 bucks goes to pay MTS, this 20 bucks goes to groceries, you know, etc. And then we'll Russ and the support worker will go to the teller and we'll ask for the perfect denominations and we'll put it in the envelope, and then we'll ask Russ if we can actually carry the cash, because if we don't at a stoplight, it could disappear with Russ out the car door. That's happened a few times. So we'll put it sometimes in the driver's side of the door. That's preferably where we'll put it. And so it's out of sight, out of mind. And then, I'm being very, very detailed, but that's how payday happens. And that works.
And even little things like not putting temptation in his way are really important.
For example?
Well, let's say if you leave him in the car. You'd never leave him with the keys in the car because he could decide at that moment that, you know, it's coffee time on the other side of town and off he'd go. Jewel Reimer told me that there's a saying that people with FASD live 10 seconds away from disaster because one wrong decision can send them down the wrong path.
It boggles my mind many times how they survive even day to day, because the situations they can get into can be so quickly very serious and even life-threatening and all of that. They certainly live in the moment, and sometimes maybe that's a bit of a blessing. You're not anxious about tomorrow too much. And the crises kind of come and go, and it must be incredibly stressful to kind of live that roller coaster existence. But perhaps one of the good things is that you experience the crisis, and then the next day it's a brand new day.
Jewel, as you can tell, tries to keep her sense of humor when she can.
I guess you'd need it. Suzanne, it's been years now that we've had publicity campaigns aimed at educating women about the dangers of drinking while they're pregnant. Is that making some kind of a dent, at least, in the numbers of people who have FASD?
Well, that's a really good question, Sheila, but it's impossible to answer. Because almost 35 years after FAS became a medical diagnosis, no one nationally is keeping track. In fact, we didn't even have national guidelines for diagnosing it until 2005. And while we do have some quality services, the experts I spoke with say we don't have enough of them. In Manitoba, for example, Brenda and Jewel tell me that if you're an adult, you can't even get a formal diagnosis here. Another issue is public awareness and prevention. The NDP introduced a private members' motion in 2001 that was overwhelmingly passed by Parliament, calling for labels on all bottles of alcohol warning of the dangers of drinking while pregnant, something that they've actually been doing in the state since 1989. But the government has yet to enact it here.
So if Russ hadn't been diagnosed with FAS when he was young, he might have completely slipped through the cracks then?
Absolutely.
What about the courts? Is FASD a factor there?
Well, Sheila, the judge can take it into consideration during sentencing, but let's not forget that being diagnosed as an older teen or an adult in Manitoba is next to impossible. There are also issues around a person's ability to even stand trial, instruct counsel, or even be a reliable witness. Dr. Ab Chudley is a medical geneticist and a pediatrician who has a real interest in FASD. He calls the diagnostic process cumbersome, and he says it's expensive because there's no accurate biological marker, no brain scan or blood test to identify people.
We don't know how many people in prisons are affected by prenatal alcohol exposure. I think it's fairly high. Our study in Stony Mountain showed with very conservative, very rigorous assessments, and it's probably an underestimate, about 10% are affected in the federal penitentiary in Stony. But then you put them in there and you put them into programs that don't work for individuals with brain injury. And, you know, those are being developed now, but until you identify the individuals, then you don't know who to enroll in those programs. So it becomes a problem.
At least 10% of the inmates suffer from fetal alcohol exposure.
Yeah, and that's one small study in one prison in one province.
Boy, there's a lot to consider here for sure. Suzanne, where does Russ see his life going? He's got some support now. He's got the girlfriend. What's next for him and his family?
Well, I'll let Audrey and Russ tell you.
It's very stressful. There are times when, you know, you still have to keep giving advice, which all parents do, but more than average parent. But they're not still going to listen to you all the time. And you can't say, well, I told you so. You'd like to, but you have to say, can you think of anything along the way, any advice along the way that was given to you that would have helped you in this situation? And if they say no, then they've totally forgotten. Because they can't keep all those things together. I really feel sorry for them. And I know there's too many people to have them all supported. We just feel very fortunate that we were able to get this support for Russ. I mean, there have been times when I've said to MCC FASD, I hope you don't give up on Russ. And they've said, we won't. And that's very comforting. I just hope and pray that they can always keep running that agency and working with the people that they are working with.
What would I like? I would like to live with my family, you know, to live with my family, to live with minimal of supports. I know I need the full-time supports right now, but, you know, what are you saying? 10, 15, 20 years down the road, I can, you know, cut back to an hour a day or 2 hours a day of support, you know? Yeah. Yeah. That's my goal. That's my dream.
But for now, Sheila, they're both taking it one day at a time.
Suzanne, thank you for introducing us to Russ and to Audrey. What a story.
Oh, you're very welcome, Sheila.
Suzanne Dufresne is our producer in Winnipeg. If you have any experience with FAS in any aspect of fetal alcohol syndrome, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is soundslikecanada@cbc.ca, and our postal address is Box 4600, Vancouver, BC, V6B4A2. That's the best of Sounds Like Canada. Highlights from our show on CBC Radio 1, heard weekday mornings at 10 o'clock. I'm Sheila Rogers. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.